Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. World, Middle East, air war in Iran gives way to crippling stalemate in Hormuz. The economic toll and escalation risks in the Strait persists amid a prolonged test of wills, by Georgi Kanchev, Jared Melson, and Summer Saeed. The conflict with Iran has entered a damaging new phase, a crippling limbo between war and peace that leaves the Strait of Hormuz closed and the prospect of escalation looming. The missiles and bombs that the U.S. and Israel rained down on Iran and Tehran's retaliatory salvos might have stopped with President Trump's indefinite extension of a ceasefire. But the battle for control of the Strait, one of the most important conduits of global trade, is raging, leaving commodity traders on edge and helping push international oil prices above $100 a barrel on Wednesday. Iranian forces attacked three cargo ships on Wednesday, said people familiar with the fighting. Meanwhile, the U.S. Navy sought to keep Iran from exporting oil, the country's main revenue source, or receiving supplies. Arab mediators working to restart talks between the two sides say they feared the situation would deteriorate. Iran's negotiating team has toughened its tone since deciding at the last minute to skip talks this week on Islamabad, the Pakistani capital, vowing not to return to the table until the blockade is lifted. Mediators said, "Diplomacy is a tool for securing national interests and security," Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Esmail Baghdadi said Wednesday. "The ceasefire is inherently unstable," said Ali Vaez, the director of the Iran Project at International Crisis Group. "At sea, neither Washington nor Tehran is de-escalating, so much as testing the limits of coercion. As long as the double blockade stays in place, every interdiction, warning shot, or ship seizure becomes a possible trigger for a wider relapse into conflict." Trump said Tuesday on social media that the blockade would remain in place to keep pressure on Iran until talks between the two countries end. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has said it would keep the strait closed to what it calls hostile shipping. "Neither side is likely to fold under economic pressure anytime soon," Vaez said. Mediators, including Turkey, Pakistan, and Egypt, were scrambling Wednesday to get the diplomatic process back on track. Officials said the U.S. and Iran continued to exchange messages through third parties, but reported little progress. The Trump administration imposed the blockade earlier in April in an attempt to pile economic pressure on Iran and reclaim the upper hand after Iran closed the crucial shipping lane. Iran's renewed attacks on commercial vessels in the vicinity of the strait highlighted the slow-burning tit-for-tat battle playing out in the waters around the region. The attacks came after U.S. forces on Tuesday seized a crude oil tanker in the Indian Ocean that had been sanctioned for working with Iran. On Wednesday, the Greek-owned Epaminondas, a Liberian-flagged container ship, reported heavy damage after coming under fire from a Revolutionary Guard gunboat, according to the United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations Center, which is affiliated with the British Navy. A second cargo ship came under fire west of Iran, according to the UKMTO, which monitors threats to shipping. A third ship, the Francesca, a box ship owned by Geneva-based Mediterranean Shipping, came under attack while waiting to cross into the Gulf of Oman, one of the people familiar with the matter said. The Epaminondas said, and the Francesca were escorted to the waters off Iran's coast after the attacks, the people familiar with the matter said. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Navy wrote on X that it had confiscated the vessels and guided them to Iran's shore. Despite the pounding its military has taken from the U.S. and Israeli strikes, the Revolutionary Guard's Mosquito fleet of hundreds of small fast attack boats can still threaten commercial shipping, which remains moribund absent ironclad assurances that vessels won't be attacked. The prolonged instability has heightened the risk of a nightmare economic scenario in which the strait remains effectively closed for months to come, adding to inflationary pressures and deepening a global economic slowdown. As it goes on, we could see oil prices getting higher and some stagflationary risks mounting. So this is going to weigh on global consumers, said Rachel Ziemba, an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, a Washington-based think tank. More than 10 million barrels a day of oil and petroleum products, some 10% of global supply, are bottled up in the strait. Soaring costs are already forcing industries to scale down their energy consumption, a process known as demand destruction, where businesses and consumers are forced to cut back on to balance the massive supply shortfall. There will be more demand destruction than supply additions, Ziemba said. That could cause cascading effects for the global economy. The International Monetary Fund warned last week that under a severe scenario, where the conflict continues for months and keeps oil prices elevated, world economic growth could fall to 2% in 2026, a rate seen only during the deepest recent global recessions. That compares with the IMF's main or reference scenario, in which there is a quick resolution and global output grows by 3.1% this year. The conflict has already proven more disruptive to global energy markets than the 1973 oil crisis. The fallout extends far beyond crude. Supply chains are also gummed up for helium, crucial for the artificial intelligence chips boom, and fertilizers, essential for global food security. Aluminum prices are near a four-year high that was reached earlier this month amid war-related smelter closures across the Gulf, which accounts for around 10% of global supply. Analysts at Rabobank wrote in a note to clients Wednesday that if the Hormuz closure continues, critical energy and goods are not going to flow for longer, with exponentially rising economic damage. The U.S. buoyed its large domestic energy industry and booming AI build-out is positioned to weather the storm, but it isn't immune if the crisis continues. Inflation is already climbing on the back of rising commodity costs. The Federal Reserve could eventually be forced to choose between keeping inflation in check through sustained higher rates and cushioning the domestic economy. Trump has conceded that energy prices might not fall soon and could still be higher when voters head to polls in midterm elections this fall. A prolonged closure of the strait would hit Asia the hardest. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, more than 80% of the oil and liquefied natural gas moving through the choke point went to Asian markets in 2024. This impact is already rippling through major manufacturing hubs, forcing some factories to slash production and gas stations in Sri Lanka and Myanmar to ration fuel. Europe is grappling with its own deepening slowdown. A growing jet fuel shortage has hit airports across the continent, with no quick fix in sight. On Tuesday, Germany's Lufthansa said it would cancel some European routes and 20,000 short-haul flights scheduled until October in a bid to ration jet fuel. A continued standoff risks inflicting further damage on the Gulf countries, which have borne the brunt of Iran's retaliatory strikes so far. Regional energy exporters remain unable to get most of their supplies to market. Qatar suffered major damage to its LNG facilities, with repairs expected to take up to 5 years. Consulting firm Rystad Energy estimates that repairing damaged energy infrastructure across the region could cost as much as $58 billion. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are managing to route some of their oil exports around the Hormuz blockage. But the war is hitting their core business proposition, being oases of stability within a volatile region and delivering a blow to efforts to diversify their economies beyond energy. The war has forced the cancellation of marquee events in the Gulf, including financial conferences and Formula One races, hurting the region's booming tourism sector. It is also threatening the Gulf's aggressive push into technology and AI, particularly after high-profile infrastructure, including Amazon data centers, were struck in the war. Politics, national security. Pete Hegseth fires Navy Secretary John Phelan. The shakeup comes as the U.S. military is enforcing a massive naval blockade of Iranian ports in the Middle East. By Laura Seligman, Marcus Weisgerber, and Alexander Ward. John Phelan has been fired as Navy Secretary after months of simmering tension with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, according to U.S. officials. His departure was revealed in a social media post by Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell. In the post, Parnell said Hegseth and Deputy Defense Secretary Steve Feinberg were grateful to Secretary Phelan for his service to the Department of the United States Navy. Hung Cao, a Navy veteran who is the current undersecretary, will become the acting Navy Secretary, Parnell said. Cao lost a bid for Virginia's Senate seat to Democrat Tim Kaine in 2024. The shakeup comes as the U.S. military is enforcing a massive naval blockade of Iranian ports in the Middle East. There are more than 15 warships already in the region to support operations against Iran. Hegseth dismissed Phelan in a phone call just minutes before Parnell's statement was posted, according to a person with knowledge of the discussions. Phelan had spent the day on Capitol Hill talking to lawmakers about the Navy's budget request, the person said. Pentagon officials told congressional aides on Wednesday that Hegseth fired Phelan because he and Feinberg felt that the Navy Secretary wasn't moving quickly enough on President Trump's shipbuilding priorities, according to two people with knowledge of the discussions. Trump agreed with Hegseth that it was time for a new Navy leadership, according to a senior administration official. Phelan's firing comes after a rocky tenure under Hegseth and Feinberg, including tension over Phelan's close relationship with Trump, according to three people familiar with the internal discussions. Phelan regularly chats with Trump at his Mar-a-Lago club just down the street from his own Florida home and told lawmakers last year that he exchanges texts with the president about shipbuilding in the middle of the night. The top Pentagon leaders were particularly annoyed last fall when Phelan pitched the idea for a modern battleship directly to Trump, bypassing Hegseth, the people said. Since then, Hegseth and Feinberg have worked to undermine Phelan by creating a new czar for submarine acquisition, a portfolio that typically sits within the Navy, who reports directly to Feinberg, the people said. Another source of tension between Hegseth and Phelan was Hegseth's firing of John Harrison, Phelan's chief of staff, in October, days after the Senate vote to confirm Cao as the Navy's undersecretary. Phelan and Harrison had worked to limit the influence of the undersecretary job before Cao stepped into the role, Politico reported. It is just the latest example of friction between Hegseth and some of his senior Pentagon staff. The defense secretary has fired nearly two dozen senior military officers, including most recently General Randy George, the Army Chief of Staff, and has been feuding with the Army Secretary Dan Driscoll since early last year. The firing comes in the middle of the Navy's biggest conference of the year, after Phelan spent the past few days pitching defense industry and the media on the Navy's top priorities. It also comes the day after the Pentagon rolled out the details of its budget request to Congress, including $65.8 billion for shipbuilding. Phelan didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Before serving as Navy Secretary, Phelan founded a Palm Beach-based private investment firm called Rugger Management. He and his wife Amy, a former Dallas Cowboys cheerleader, are prominent art collectors who fundraise millions of dollars for Trump's campaign. Phelan was sworn in as Navy Secretary in March 2025. Phelan stood alongside Trump and Hegseth at Mar-a-Lago in December to announce the Navy would build a new class of battleships named after the president. The battleship would be the centerpiece of a so-called Golden Fleet of new warships. The day before he was dismissed, Phelan addressed a large industry conference touting his record, including the Navy meeting its recruiting goals ahead of schedule and accelerating the adoption of artificial intelligence. "We are reforming how this department does business, but we are still in the early stages of organizational and cultural reform to modernize our fleet," Phelan said. And on to our next story. Politics, policy. Republicans are worried that the redistricting fight is backfiring. After a victory in Virginia, some analysts say Democrats may pick up more seats in Congress following the nationwide redistricting battle. By Aaron Zittner, Alex Leary, and Terrell Wright. Republicans are increasingly worried that a battle President Trump started last summer to redraw congressional district lines has backfired and may hand more seats to Democrats. At best, some Republicans say the effort will produce only a small gain in the number of GOP House seats instead of the firewall the party was hoping to build to stave off defeat in the midterm elections. Some in the party said on Wednesday that Trump and his aides had miscalculated by pressing Texas last year to undertake an unusual mid-decade effort to draw new House district lines to the GOP's advantage, which prompted several Democratic-leaning states to redraw their own maps in response. And some question why Trump's political machine didn't spend more resources on Tuesday's election in Virginia, given the narrow outcome. Voters in Virginia on Tuesday passed one of the nation's most aggressive gerrymanders that, should it survive court challenges, would put Democrats in position to win 10 of the state's 11 House seats and leave the party with a slight overall advantage in the nationwide redistricting war, which so far has yielded new House maps in 7 states. A redistricting approved by California voters last November could add up to 5 Democratic seats. We should have anticipated and played 3 or 4 moves ahead. We should have known that there was going to be a response to Texas, said Representative Don Bacon, Republican Nebraska, who is retiring after this year. He added, we'll pay for it in November. Representative Suhas Subramaniam, a Virginia Democrat, who championed the new districts in the state, said, people are fed up with this administration, especially in Virginia. Trump is historically unpopular there. He said the vote reflected the desire to even the playing field. The chess match isn't over, and it is impossible at this point to predict exactly how many seats will change hands. The battle turns next to Florida, which is slated to take up a redistricting plan next week that could add Republican seats. Louisiana and potentially other GOP-leaning states could also draw new maps if given the green light under a Supreme Court case regarding racial considerations in redistricting, for which a ruling is expected by the end of June. But the state of the redistricting battle, as of now, has left many in the GOP frustrated. Unleashing Texas was bad for the nation, and it turned out to be bad for the GOP, said Ari Fleischer, White House press secretary to former President George W. Bush. This was avoidable, and if Texas hadn't gone first, it is conceivable that Republicans actually would be better off than where they are now. So Republicans picked the fight and lost the fight, he said. GOP leaders in Congress showed little enthusiasm for the fight Wednesday. Representative Richard Hudson of North Carolina, who leads the GOP's House election arm, distanced himself from the redistricting effort. It's not for me to decide that, he said. It's not my decision. The Senate Republican leader, Senator John Thune of South Dakota, said that when you go down the path of starting to do these things mid-decade, these are the kinds of outcomes you're going to run into. Analysts who have assessed the new maps put in place so far see Democrats as now with a slight advantage. Jacob Rubashkin of Inside Elections, a nonpartisan newsletter, said the Democratic gain could be as large as 3 or 4 seats, depending on what changes Florida and potentially other states make. The Cook Political Report wrote that the Virginia outcome gave Democrats an edge in the mid-decade redistricting wars, and that the ultimate outcome would be a minimal effect on the battle for the House majority. Evidence from the recent off-cycle elections shows that a more powerful factor in the fight to control the House could be the advantage that Democrats have shown, at least until now, in motivation to vote. The Virginia outcome left Republicans citing What they said was unfairness, and the new map, as they called on the Virginia Supreme Court to invalidate it. The court is considering several challenges to the constitutional amendment that voters approved by 51.5% to 48.5% on Tuesday. The amendment would put the new Democratic-advantaged map in place temporarily until lawmakers draw new districts after the 2030 census, following customary practice. On Wednesday, a circuit court in Virginia barred state election officials from certifying Tuesday's vote, saying the ballot question violated procedural rules and the state constitution. The ruling means the new map can't go into effect for now, but the matter is sure to wind up before the state's high court. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, called the proposed Virginia map a hyperpartisan gerrymandering boondoggle, and called on the court to strike it down. This is a divided state. It is almost 50-50. So a 10-to-1 map is not justified in that state, Johnson said, referring to the balance of Democratic and Republican-leaning districts under the new lines. Some House Republicans, particularly those who could be affected by redistricting moves, have for months questioned the White House strategy, which was spearheaded by James Blair, a deputy chief of staff who recently took leave to oversee Trump's political apparatus for the midterm elections. Blair defended the effort Wednesday, saying Democrats have already been using courts to push for more favorable maps in some states. Blair said the Republican turnout in Virginia showed the party, which has suffered a number of electoral defeats since Trump returned to office, would be motivated in November. What I expect is that when all this redistributing sort of continues this cycle, is that there will be a narrow advantage for Republicans, Blair said on CNN. The White House directed questions to the Republican National Committee, which pointed to funding for voter engagement efforts and a legal fight against the Democratic plan. Some Republicans said it was wrong to say that Trump had picked the fight when he called on Texas to redraw its House district lines, a process that could net the GOP as many as 5 seats. They cited a map that Democratic-led New York approved in 2024 and efforts in other states to use civil rights laws to challenge districts. This has been an ongoing redistricting battle for the better part of a decade now, said Adam Kincaid, who leads the GOP's redistricting arm, the National Republican Redistricting Trust. The spate of highly partisan mid-decade redistricting efforts threatens to create extreme mismatches between the partisan makeup of some states and their representation in Congress. Trump won 46% of the vote in 2024 in Virginia, and his party holds 45% of the state's U.S. House seats. That could fall to 9% under the new map. Democrats won 42% of the presidential vote in Texas, but could wind up with 21% of House seats under the new map. Representative Mike Lawler, a Republican who represents a competitive district in New York, called the redistricting battle mutually assured destruction, and it is completely the antithesis of representative democracy. And on to our next story. Business, autos, Tesla surprises Wall Street with better profits, $1.4 billion in free cash flow. The carmaker expects $25 billion in capital spending this year and expanded its robo-taxi service in Dallas and Houston, by Becky Peterson. Tesla reported better revenue and earnings in the first quarter and surprised Wall Street with positive free cash when compared with last year's period. The company reported $22.4 billion in revenue for the first quarter, up 16% from the first quarter of last year. Revenue from its automotive business increased 16% from the year prior, and the company said the recent run-up in gasoline prices has helped sales slightly. Energy business revenue, which comes from selling industrial and residential battery storage, was previously a bright spot for the company, but it fell 12% in the first quarter. Even so, Tesla's net income grew 17%. And despite analyst consensus that the company could have negative free cash flow for the first time in 2 years, Tesla reported positive free cash flow at $1.4 billion. Chief Financial Officer Vaibhav Taneja said Tesla will have negative free cash flow for the rest of the year as it prepares to spend $25 billion on capital expenditures in 2026. We believe this is the right strategy to position the company for the next era, Taneja said. While the first quarter results show a rebound over last year, they mark a steady decline in revenue and earnings since the third quarter peak last year when Tesla's sales were spurred by an expiring federal tax credit of $7,500 per vehicle. The company, which is led by Chief Executive Elon Musk, spent $2.5 billion on capital expenditures in the quarter as it expanded its capacity for artificial intelligence computing and worked on new production lines, including the Cybercab robo-taxi. Tesla's working on a lot of large, ambitious projects that are all very challenging, but I think are going to be very revolutionary, Musk said. In a slide deck presented to investors, the company showed off a large plot of land near its Giga Texas factory, where it is preparing for construction on a new facility it says will house the production line for the second generation of Optimus humanoid robots. The facility is designed to manufacture 10 million robots a year. Tesla will also build a smaller line at its Fremont, California factory for its first generation Optimus robots, replacing factory lines used to manufacture the recently canceled Model S and Model X luxury vehicles. Tesla shares initially rose as much as 4.4% in aftermarket trading, but were down 1% from the closing price after Musk's call with investors and analysts ended. Tesla sold 358,023 EVs globally in the first quarter, which was up 6.3% from the year before. Despite the growth from last year, it was Tesla's second worst sales quarter since 2022. The company also increased subscriptions of its driver assist software, which is called Full Self-Driving, supervised, to 1.28 million subscribers. That is up 16.4% compared with the prior quarter and a 51% increase compared with the year before. Tesla is focused on selling more subscriptions of its FSD software, which it offers for $99 a month, as it tries to pivot its business away from vehicle sales to focus on autonomous vehicles and humanoid robots, neither of which is currently for sale. The company said it plans to start volume production of its autonomous Cybercab and fully electric semi-truck this year. Tesla is also expanding its robo-taxi ride-hailing service. On Saturday, the company said it started offering fully autonomous rides in a small area of Dallas and Houston, Texas, in addition to Austin, where it started offering a small number of fully autonomous rides in January. The company also has a ride-hailing service in California with safety drivers behind the wheel. Its company is also preparing to expand the service to other major cities, including Phoenix, Miami, and Las Vegas. U.S. Education News. The for-profit education company scooping up millions of welfare dollars. States tap federal money to fund $1 million star academies. Some schools are underwhelmed by results. By Dan Frosch and Scott Calvert. John Alvanita's for-profit education company seemed to have flopped in West Virginia. The four public school districts that were testing his Star Academy program, which promises to turn around the performance of struggling middle school students, had stopped using it. One school reported worsening behavior and less improvements in English and math for Star Academy students than for other kids. That didn't stop West Virginia Governor Patrick Morrisey from sending more businesses to Alvanita, who earlier had donated nearly $42,000 to his campaign and affiliated political committees. In January, the Republican governor announced plans to tap the state's unspent funds from the federal Temporary Assistance for Needy Families welfare program, called TEMF, to expand Star Academy. The deal would play Avendia's New Orleans-based company, NOLA Education. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Now continuing on with our story. As much as $16 million to put the program in 16 other schools. Elected officials from both parties have steered millions of taxpayer dollars to no bid contracts for the Star Academy program in several states, records show. Some school districts and state officials have expressed misgivings about the program's cost and effectiveness. Wall Street Journal interviews with local officials and an examination of school performance data show Avenida and his company have overstated its results in some of those places, including claims it freed an Arkansas school district from state oversight and boosted a Chicago area school's graduation rate by 65 percentage points. NOLA Education said since 2018, it has operated in more than 150 sites, which typically pay $1 million for the program. It is one of many for-profit companies that have carved out businesses vowing to help turn around troubled public schools, often by tapping public money. We've got a lot of kids out there that are in very high poverty areas with no hope, Alvanita said in an interview, and we're bringing hope to these kids. He said his company's own data on the schools where Star Academy operates shows his program works. Much of the money for Star Academy comes from federal funding streams such as TANF, which gives states wide latitude on how to help poor families. Because school districts typically don't have to pay for Star Academy out of their own coffers, signing up can be a no-risk proposition. States spend billions of TANF dollars each year, often directing funds to a variety of programs and companies. There is little federal oversight and minimal reporting requirements on whether such programs work, which has fueled criticism that TANF is a slush fund for states. Both the Trump and Biden administration have criticized the misuse of TANF and lax oversight of its use. University of Southern California education professor Patricia Birch questioned giving major funding to companies whose programs haven't undergone evidence-based scrutiny. Kids in poverty are often test cases for untested kinds of curriculum, she said. NOLA Education typically gets the $1 million over 3 years to set up a Star Academy in a school. The company describes it as a school within a school with specialized furniture, software, and supplies. Literally, we pull an 18-wheeler up to the door and we drop off all this equipment, all these materials, right down to the extra ink cartridges for the printers, said Alvendia, a 61-year-old engineer turned salesman. Star Academy trains teachers at participating schools to run the program, which focuses on hands-on math and science instruction, or STEM, and small classes for students who have fallen behind. Schools provide the classrooms and pay the teachers. After the initial 3-year contract, the cost of using Star Academy's curriculum drops sharply, so the company depends on signing up new school districts. Avendia studied electrical engineering and worked at Chevron before teaming up with fellow engineer John Lee to launch JRL Enterprises in the 1990s. Their product, I Can Learn, was an interactive computer-based algebra program. That company was embroiled in a public corruption scandal. In 2007, a former Orleans Parish school board president pleaded guilty to taking some $140,000 in kickbacks from a JRL salesman in return for purchasing $14 million in I Can Learn contracts. JRL wasn't charged. Alvendia, who left the company in 2008, said he wasn't involved in the scandal. With a $127,000 federal tax lien on his New Orleans area home in 2007 and a bank foreclosing on a second home in Florida, Alvendia joined Star Academy as a national salesman. At that time, the program was owned by Pitsco Education, a Kansas company that develops science and math products and curriculum. A decade later, Alvendia launched NOLA Education and bought Star Academy. He believed he could turn the concept into a juggernaut. He laid out his approach in a salesmanship blog he wrote in 2016. Persuade people your product can save lives and government money, and identify influential politicians to be your advocate. Avendia said recently that his strategy was to use data to attract business. Disputed claims. Rich Township High School District 227 in Chicago's south suburbs set up a Star Academy in the 2019-20 school year, but discontinued it after 3 years. School spokesman Matthew Shank said the program didn't run long enough for the district to determine whether it was not working. On a Nevada public television show in 2024, Avendia claimed Star Academy lifted the graduation rate at Rich Township from 13% to 78%. In a 2025 charter school application, NOLA Education and a Louisiana nonprofit it was working with repeated the claim. The Rich Township school spokesman disputed the assertion, saying, "Those percentages are not accurate." Avendia said a school district staffer had provided the data through tears, told him Star Academy had changed students' lives. "I don't have a scientific certified document, but that's information that we get," he said. Avendia also said Star Academy's success ended state oversight of a troubled Pine Bluff, Arkansas school district in 2023 after 5 years. On the Nevada TV show, he said 15 Star Academy students at one failing Pine Bluff school did so well they lifted the school out of an F rating and bumped the whole district out of state control. He told the Journal he heard this from the superintendent, among others. Asked about Avendia's claim, an Arkansas Education Department spokeswoman shared the link to the hours-long meeting where the state restored full local control. No one mentioned Star Academy. She said the board examined the performance, leadership, safety, and financial stability of the district, not a single school or student. Pine Bluff Superintendent Jennifer Barbary declined to comment on Avendia's claims about Star Academy, which she said was paid for using Biden administration COVID-era aid for school districts. Officials at some school districts praised Star Academy. In St. Mary Parish, Louisiana, a state grant paid for Star Academy at Franklin Junior High School beginning in 2022. "Our kids really like the hands-on part of it," said Jay Ina, the principal. After initial gains in standardized test scores at Franklin Junior High, scores have fallen since sharply, state records show. Ina attributed the fall-off to factors such as teacher turnover and a move to a new school building last year. In the mining community of Elko, Nevada, Superintendent Clayton Anderson used a Labor Department grant to start the program 2 years ago at Adobe Middle School. Anderson said Star Academy has re-engaged students who were often absent literally and mentally. "Star Academy gave these students a reason to believe in themselves," Anderson said in an email. "They discovered something they are good at, something they are passionate about, and that changed their whole outlook." The Elko School District said it hadn't compiled its own data on the performance of Star Academy students. Instead, it provided the Journal with statistics compiled by NOLA Education that showed improvements among more than 200 students, far more than were enrolled in Star Academy. By one measure, Adobe Middle School has lost ground since Star Academy arrived. The school dropped last year from 2 stars to 1 in Nevada's state rankings. 1 star means a school needs to urgently address areas significantly below the state standard. Political play. State agencies hiring outside companies often publish a request for proposal or RFP, enabling multiple potential contractors to bid. In many cases, Avendia bypassed the process by persuading states to earmark money for Star Academy. "Rather than spending all my time chasing RFPs and leftover funding, I work with lobbyists to grab the first pieces of the pie," he wrote in his blog in 2016. "With these power brokers, I pursue funding from the politicians that grant money to the government departments that use my products." In Louisiana, Alvendia's home base, 62 Star Academies operate in 49 schools. Last year, Republican Governor Jeff Landry signed a budget that included $20 million for Star Academy to expand, the second biggest expenditure of Louisiana's annual TANF allotment. Landry's current budget proposal includes another $20 million in TANF dollars for Star Academy. Over the years, Alvendia and NOLA Education have donated tens of thousands of dollars to Louisiana politicians' records show. Last year, Landry appointed him to the governor's Higher Education Reform Task Force. Alvendia said his donations are an effort to get the attention of lawmakers so he can pitch them on Star Academy. If I could talk to a governor and that conversation, 2-3 minutes, leads to, let me show you what we can do, then yeah, that's exactly it, he said. We have seen Louisiana students go from all Fs to straight A's because of this program, Landry said in a written statement to the journal. Star Academy gives our students the opportunity to experience hands-on learning, and the results speak for themselves. A Landry spokeswoman cited a 2025 news story quoting a Star Academy student saying this is what happened to her. Both Alvendia and his brother Roderick, a Louisiana personal injury lawyer, have donated tens of thousands of dollars in other states where the company is pursuing contracts. In Kentucky, Democratic Governor Andy Beshear included in last year's budget $5 million from the state's general fund to pilot 5-star academies and proposed an additional $15 million in state dollars to expand the program. Last July, Roderick Alvendia's law firm gave $25,000 to Beshear's Political Action Committee. Roderick Alvendia didn't respond to requests for comments. The Republican-controlled legislature reduced Beshear's $15 million Star Academy proposal to $2 million over the next two fiscal years. In February, records show John Alvendia contributed $10,000 to the state Republican Party. A Beshear spokeswoman said partnering with Star Academy shows how you can innovate within public schools and reflects the two-term governor's push to prioritize public education. In New Mexico, Alvendia hired a former top advisor to Democratic Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham to lobby for a Star Academy contract with the state. Lujan Grisham's office urged state education officials to consider the program for Albuquerque public schools despite concerns about its effectiveness, according to people familiar with the matter. The Albuquerque School District rejected a $2 million no-bid contract for Star Academy proposed by the state. A spokesman for the governor said improving schools is a priority for her administration. NOLA Education listed New Mexico on its website as one of 20 states where it operates, but removed it after the journal asked Alvendia about it. In West Virginia, where the four districts stopped using the program after testing it, Governor Morrisey's office said it expects to roll out Star Academies over the next several years. Earlier this year, Morrisey praised the four pilot programs for an 81% decrease in behavioral incidents and a 63% increase in attendance. A spokesman for Morrisey said those statistics came from a Star Academy report. One of the middle schools that tested it was in Logan County. Star Academy's website says that the schools had 92% stronger attendance and 72% fewer incidents. A district spokesman said those figures weren't reported by Logan County, which abandoned the program before the pilot ended. Data the district shared with the journal showed behavioral incidents among Star Academy students increased by 2/3 last year, while attendance edged lower. In January, the district abandoned Star Academy halfway through its 3-year pilot. I honestly can't explain that, Alvendia said. We get our data from school staff, so if they tell us one thing and they tell you something else, I don't know. He said he was disappointed in the rollout of the West Virginia pilots and that there was resistance among school staff to using Star Academy. Christy Day, a spokeswoman for the State Education Department, said she believed Logan County's response to questions from the Journal reflects a shared sentiment among other pilot sites. A spokeswoman for another West Virginia school district that stopped using Star Academy after its pilot expired said the program's model didn't align with state policy on student learning and educational achievement. Morrissey's spokesman said the pilot had shown the state what worked and what could be improved. Unlike in the pilot, where the four districts and schools were selected, districts would now need to apply to use it. When asked about Elvendia's campaign contributions, the spokesman said the governor bases decisions on what's best for West Virginians. Technology, artificial intelligence. Workers sue $10 billion AI startup for collecting and exposing personal data. Mercor, which has worked with OpenAI, Anthropic, and Meta, disputes the allegations, by Catherine Bindley. Training artificial intelligence models demands massive amounts of fresh data. Mercor, a $10 billion startup that hires contractors to provide AI training feedback, is among those leading the high-stakes hunt. Sometimes that quest for data leads to contentious territory. The San Francisco startup, whose clients have included OpenAI, Anthropic, and Meta, has been hit with at least seven class action lawsuits in recent weeks following a third-party data breach. Allegedly, it exposed Mercor contractor information ranging from recorded job interviews to facial biometric data and screenshots of workers' computers. The suits offered a window into how Mercor allegedly acquires the data used to serve its customers. A class action suit filed Tuesday in Northern California alleged that Mercor accumulated applicant vetting data, including background checks, which it shared with partners in breach of federal regulations. According to plaintiffs, the company's practices included monitoring its contractors' computers and sharing that data with clients, using recorded candidate interviews to train AI models and training client models on materials potentially owned by other companies. We strongly dispute the speculative claims in these lawsuits and look forward to presenting the facts at the appropriate time and place, Mercor said in a statement. We take the privacy of our customers, contractors, employees, and those we interview very seriously, and we comply with all relevant laws and regulations, the statement continued, adding that the company acted promptly to remediate the data breach and that the breach affected many other companies as well. We are conducting a thorough investigation with leading third-party forensics experts and are communicating directly with affected stakeholder groups as we have findings, it said. Previously, the Wall Street Journal reported that Mercor sought to buy prior work materials from people on LinkedIn. Those people said they didn't own the rights to such work. Mercor has been offering to pay $100 for each contractor's personal finance documents, such as spreadsheets and PowerPoint presentations, according to postings online. The company has offered $100 for people's Google Map histories. Seeking out and handling so much data comes with complications. As workers' screenshots are alleged to be included in the breached data, contractors are suing Mercor not only for exposing their own personal information, but also the information of their employers. Meta has paused its work with Mercor and is investigating the incident, according to a company spokesman. Meta's Mercor pause was earlier reported by Wired. Anthropic declined to comment. OpenAI didn't respond to requests for comment. To train the first generation of large language models, AI developers already identified and extracted most major readily available sources of the world's data. Now companies have to get specialized, said Shane Longpre, an MIT PhD candidate who researches AI. A lot of the data acquisition strategies seem to be moving toward more specialist sources, he said, pointing to those who are extremely knowledgeable and have executed complex tasks in finance, healthcare, law, and the sciences. Mercor hired 30,000 contractors in 2025. Its competitors include Handshake AI, Micro One, and Surge, Recently, LinkedIn started testing its own AI training marketplace. The testing was earlier reported by Business Insider. Handshake co-founder Garrett Lord recently posted to LinkedIn that his company was looking to purchase code bases, internal databases, and more. "We anonymize everything," he wrote. "The stuff that's not on the internet is what we need." The way big AI labs work with Mercor and other intermediaries who use contractors can make responsibility for data provenance more ambiguous, Longpre said. Industry-wide, he added, there's an incentive right now to figure out the rules and regulations after and to capture as much of the market in the short term first. Real-world scenarios. Thitipun Sirivanagh, a plaintiff in the class action lawsuit filed Tuesday, alleged that project managers and reviewers at Mercor encourage workers to use real data from their firms, so long as the source was redacted or slightly changed. When Srinivasan wrote in a way so as to protect confidential information, reviewers criticized the work as too short and vague, the suit said. David Bovino-Berve, a Mercor contractor who previously worked at Goldman Sachs, alleges in the same suit that he saw financial models and prompts that he suspected came from workers sharing proprietary information from other companies. He also saw pre-project metadata, hidden defined names, institutional data terminal markers, real lender or counterparty names, irregular numeric precision, and other features that raise serious provenance questions, the suit said. One contractor, a federal investigator, told the Journal that Mercor asks for real-world scenarios but doesn't ask for prior work or proprietary data that might belong to other companies. However, the investigator added, the company scrubs data to remove personal or business identifiers in case contractors aren't abiding by its instructions. Brendan Foodie, Mercor's chief executive, said last fall at the TechCrunch Disrupt conference that while contractors are given guidance not to use data or documents from other companies, there are things that happen. He added, "That's doing everything that we can on our side." The company said its job listings state that work doesn't involve access to confidential or proprietary information from any of the workers, employers, clients, or institutions. Jennifer King, an expert in information with Stanford University's Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence, said that asking professionals to come up with real-world scenarios to train AI is tricky. Most people who do professional work don't have organic work that they've just created outside their clients or profession, she said. None of this stuff is just laying around. AI is very effective at pattern matching, so even if companies scrub data from materials that end up fed into an AI model, the model might draw inferences between the uploaded material and its original source, then connect the two, she added. Interviewing, onboarding, and working. When applying for a contract job at Mercor, applicants and former workers said they sat for a recorded interview with an unseen AI proctor. Often, no humans are involved. Once hired, they are typically required to sign non-disclosure agreements. Two contractors who worked for Mercor last year said they were tasked with comparing videos of job interviewees with their subsequent performances as contractors to improve the company's own AI systems to spot talent. A lawsuit filed in North Texas tied to the data breach alleged that interview recordings were shared with Mercor's clients. The company said it uses candidate interviews internally, not to train customer AI models. In the suit filed Tuesday, plaintiffs said the company also collected background check and other data and shared it with clients. Mercor said it doesn't share candidate background checks with its customers. When they begin work for the company, Mercor workers are required to install software called Insightful, which takes computer screenshots. Mercor contractors not involved in the suits described to the Journal an environment in which screenshots can be captured every minute. Bevo Berve, the plaintiff, who worked at Goldman Sachs, alleged that Insightful captured usage of his bank account, health insurance portals, and around 240 other applications. The suit also alleged that Bovino Berve wasn't clearly informed that Insightful would capture anything beyond his Mercor-related work. One contractor who worked as project lead for Mercor for several months last year said he was able to view the computer screenshots of every person on his project. The company said it informs workers that it may take screenshots of their work during billing hours and that it explicitly tells workers to use work-related applications while Insightful is active. Lifestyle, careers, on the clock. Why it's worth lobbying the boss to send you on that business trip. Companies are cutting back on travel, but hitting the road can help boost your career. By Callum Borchers. Americans aren't traveling for work like we used to, and there probably will be fewer business trips in our future given the rising cost of airfare, lodging, and gasoline. That might seem like good news to those of us who have had to choke down hotel room coffee to perk up after a grueling travel day. But the remaining road warriors among us have a warning. Staying home could stunt your career. You need to get out there so you can have my job one day, said Ali Asa, head of retail banking at First Bank in Nashville, Tennessee. Asa drives throughout the South to visit branches and meet with colleagues in other cities. And after these treks often end up being about more than just FaceTime. He once showed up for a breakfast meeting with another bank executive at a diner in the foothills of North Carolina. Like characters from Central Casting, they were the only people wearing suits and neither had cash. It was a reminder that the tap-to-pay lives many of us lead are far removed from a lot of other Americans' realities. Experiences like this are essential to understanding the communities where you do business, Asaya believes. At hiring and promotion time, he gives an edge to more journeyed candidates. Piece of the action. Trouble is, it's getting harder to become well-traveled. For six straight years, American companies have green-lighted fewer domestic business trips and budgeted less money for those trips than they did in 2019, according to the U.S. Travel Association. The trade group predicts the trend will continue this year. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.